Let's jump over to Lindsay. And as I mentioned earlier, I know she's got a couple questions. Lindsay, are you there? Would love for you to share some of the questions that have been coming in through the chat room.
Sure thing. The first question I have, this one comes from Nate Crawford, and he asks, what are you tracking on the sideline during the game?
What am I what on the sideline?
Sorry, what are you tracking during the sideline during the game?
We chart a couple different things. It's probably a little bit differently for us than some because we're having our edits kind of almost being done as the game is going on. We have somebody in our video room who's basically marking every play. So some things we don't need to do that maybe other people do. We chart offensive efficiency, our conversion rate. We list all of our plays and sets and transition stuff on a sheet, and we will keep track of what plays are working, not working, what our efficiency is on those. We track combinations. We do a plus minus based on who's in the game together. It may not be as important in a specific game, but over the course of time, you tend to find out sometimes that there's a common theme in what groups play well together. We track that. Whoever has got the responsibility of the opponent that night is tracking defensive adjustments. You know, the stuff that we've worked on of the other team. You know, have they made an adjustment? Should we make an adjustment? Is our switching on pick and rolls or our trapping or whatever it is working, or is there a more effective way to do it? So those are the three main things that we do. Everything else we can do pretty much off of film. Obviously, we're keeping track of fouls and timeouts and things like that. But those are the most important things. And then I always want my coaches to know who have scouted the opponent. We kind of scout the other coach in a sense. We want to know, and we'll have it in a chart ready to go. When a gun's put to that other coach's head late in the game, what will they like to do? Let's at least be have an odds thing that we can play that this coach loves to do this when the game is on the line. They're going to go to this player or this play, and then we also want to know the things like the other team's best free throw shooters, best 3-point shooters, worst free throw shooters. Those things, but those are things that we already have on a sheet before the game. The other stuff is what we've charted during the game.
Awesome. That's I love those suggestions. The next question I have comes from John Schultze, and he says, do you have one or two suggestions for coaching players who play so much better in practice than they do in games? Is it a confidence issue, or what do you attribute that to?
That's the million-dollar question. I think that some of it depends on the kid. I mean, I think that there are probably a fair amount that it's a confidence issue. I think it's the difference between going and practicing in an empty gym and not worrying about some of the mistakes you make to all of a sudden now you're playing in front of your family and your friends. You know, people who are going to critique you when you come home, I think that has something to do with it. There's a nervousness. You know, obviously, hopefully by the time they get to a higher level, that's not an issue. But I think that's a big thing. I think there is some reason for some sports psychology issues to come into it if you have a kid where it's acute in that regard. But I think some of it can come back sometimes to trying to make your practices more game-like, putting score and time on it, even having people watch your practices, sometimes invite people to come watch practices. So that becomes more the norm than the exception. You know, I think one of the things we do for our team, and our, you know, obviously our players have played in front of large crowds a long time, but even we do it in training camp. We'll have open practices with fans in there and officials, everything else, to just try to get them ready for that. If that's not the answer for the kid, then there's something much deeper than that. And it's not probably something I'm not that skilled enough to give you the answer on besides starting out with sports psychology of some sort.
Mm-hmm. I love the idea of the making the practices as game-like as possible with the fans. And, you know, I wonder how many high school coaches or even AAU coaches are able to adopt that philosophy, but I think that's a tremendous suggestion.
You know, bring the band in for a scrimmage. Open it up. Bring your parents in. Bring whoever else is in. and let them watch you play in the preseason.
That's awesome. The next question I have is from Franz Michael, and he asks, what defense do you prefer to use?
Well, we're primarily a man-to-man defense. We do play some zone to change it up. We do it against certain teams. We don't allow the ball to get in the middle of the floor. Our basic philosophy is to push it baseline. It would depend. There would be certain pick-and-roll coverages where we would change our feet and allow it to come to the middle because we were going to trap or hedge. But we try to keep the ball out of the middle of the floor more and more with the three-point line and more kids being able to shoot the three. I think it's a disaster to let the ball get it to the foul line area because you're asking for trouble. I think you're going to get the ball swung and drawn and kicked for open shots on the weak side. You're always going to have to be working on closeouts to stop the ball. Penetration gets you more fouls. Referees tend to call, we've charted this too, referees tend to call more fouls in the middle of the floor in the lane than they do on the baseline. You tend to get away with a little bit more down along the baseline behind the plane of the backboard. And when we do play zone, we actually have pretty much the same principles. We even over-exaggerate keeping the ball from getting in the middle of the floor rather than letting people zing the ball around the perimeter against the zone and get you moving two or three times. Then I think you're asking for trouble. We try to cut the floor in half if we can when we play zone.
Hmm. Nice. The next question I have is from Patrick Sluga, and he asks, speaking of the pick and roll, which you were alluding to earlier, how do you feel is the best way to defend against that type of play?
Well, it depends on the level of your kids. At our level, we see all kinds of different skill sets in the pick and rolls. I mean, when we play Seattle and you have Lauren Jackson, who's the best post player in the world right now, not only does she roll and go to the block, but she can pick and pop and shoot threes. So she creates a different problem. When you play Phoenix in our league, you have Diana Taurasi, who can shoot behind any screen and make a three, and then she plays with two post players who can pick and pop and shoot threes or roll. So I think it changes up. I think that, if I'm starting out with younger kids, the first thing we teach is to hard hedge and fight over the pick and get into the ball handler, particularly the younger the kids are, because I think it's very hard for young guards to see through all the traffic. We teach the other three players to zone up behind it and cover the open people and learn to rotate. But I think, attacking the ball handler at a younger age is important. We do a lot in our league. We push the ball away from the screen down the side. If it's a side pick and roll on the side of the floor, then we'll jam it toward the baseline and zone up and make them throw it back to a big who is, popping out. If they're a real good shooter, then we might rotate. The other thing at a younger level is that, the more hands involved in bothering the ball is pretty good. Now, if you have a team with all same size kids, then you can get away with a lot of switching. If you're playing against a team with non-shooters running the pick and roll and they're trying to get it to the roll, you can just basically push up or squeeze up on the screen and go underneath on the guard and give jump shots. I don't think there's necessarily a one way to do it that's best, because I think it depends on your team and it depends on who you're facing. We teach a bunch of pick and roll coverages and we predicate what we do that particular game by the kind of team that we're facing or the particular player. We actually, occasionally in games, will have different pick-and-roll coverages depending on who we're playing. If we're playing a non-shooter that's handling the ball, we aren't going to get out and fight them and be over. We're going to give them shots, as opposed to if Taurasi's shooting the ball, we're going to have to take that away from her. So I'd like to make it a simple thing, but if I were going back and teaching young kids, the first thing I would do would be to show very hard and trap and be aggressive and get the ball going toward half court. Obviously, it's a little bit different in the middle of the floor, but I would even maybe be more aggressive on that to get the guard going sideways instead of toward the rim.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I appreciate you answering that question. I'm actually going to follow up with the last question. And my question is, with the WNBA draft coming up, And I think many coaches have this issue as they look to, you know, who makes varsity, who makes JV, who makes the AA team, who makes the B team, maybe in their AAU program. When you're going to decide who fits in with the Connecticut Sun or who are you going to draft, do you go with best player? Do you go with best fit to the team? You alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I thought it'd be helpful for the coaches that are on the call for you to elaborate a little bit more on the point of, you know, are you selecting players who fit the team best or who are the best players available?
Well, for us, I think it changes. I'm not being evasive, but it changes a little bit from year to year. If you have a mm-hmm. team that has a lot of weaknesses, I think you go with the best player, provided you know that they're going to be a hard worker and everything else. I'll come back to that in a second, but I think you just need to get as much good talent as you can and then figure out how to do that. Now, as you've gone along and gotten better, I can be a lot more specific. I may be drafting for a specific position, or I may be drafting because I need a shooter. Last year when we completely changed our team, our window of opportunity had kind of closed on the group that we had before. We went and made a huge trade to go get Tina Charles and build around a post player, and we went out and got the best player out there. But I think if you're one of the first couple in the draft, you know, in general, you're probably up at the top of the draft because you haven't been really good for a period of time, or you got lucky on a trade. But if you're one of the teams that's trying to work your way up, you better go get the best player, provided they're not, you know, somebody you just don't want as a part of your program. And the way I go about looking at that is I see as many practices maybe as I do games when we're really tracking a player. The year that we went and made a trade to get the draft pick to get Lindsey Whalen 7 years ago, I probably saw her play in person 14, 15 times and probably practice 6 or 7 times, and I learned a lot about a player. I saw Tina Charles probably play 40 times over the course of her college career, but probably 15 times were practices, probably more than that because Connecticut's in our backyard. But I went to see them play in bad games. I had some fans ask me last year, why are you watching them play Holy Cross? Well, you know, they're going to win by 50. And I said, I want to see how Tina plays when the game's really easy. Does she bring the same intensity to a game that they're going to win by 40 as she does when they're going to have to play Stanford or North Carolina or Duke? You know, it's a little bit different. I think it's important when you put together a team to know how they fit your team. If there's a skill set that just is either a duplication or doesn't fit your team, then you have to go for a different thing. So I don't know that I'm answering the question very well, but it's not a simple answer for us. And hopefully if you're a high school coach, you're taking every good player that's out there, provided they'll play hard the way you want them to every day.
Right. No, I appreciate you you answering that last one, and I'll turn it back to Seth.
Thanks, Linz. Appreciate it. Coach, I've got two last questions for you.
Okay.
My first is, if you could start back over, what would you do differently or better?
Well, I think every young coach who's had a little bit of success early probably needs to stop themselves, as I had to do, and say, I need to make sure that I'm being a good listener, that I'm going to go and soak up as much as information as I can from all kinds of people. You know, not just the Dean Smiths, Bobby Knights, Larry Browns, Roy Williams, you know, all the coaches that we think about. I mean, my mentor was John Wooden, but I was smart enough, I think, to know that I probably need to learn from other people. I think sometimes that person you can learn from is right in front of you and you don't see it. It could be your rival coach at the freshman level in high school. It might be somebody who's really smart or they do something really well that you learn. And I think you need to be more observant about that. And I think, you know, I was fortunate enough to have some success early on, but I also think it blinds you sometimes to what else is out there or other ways to do things. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, find out who you are, what you're comfortable with, what you like. You can't be somebody else. I couldn't be John Wooden. I couldn't be Bobby Knight. I had to be Mike Tebow and figure out who that is. probably the best time I had in my coaching career was about the middle of my career. I coached in the CBA, which was at that time the minor league for the NBA. And it was kind of like my own working laboratory. And I got to try things and do things and experiment that, you know, you probably couldn't do if you were taking a head coaching job in the NBA at the same time. But you have to find out who you are and what you're comfortable with. And then the last thing was would be I wish I had learned early on to be more perceptive about knowing that there's a lot of different ways to learn and say things, which we covered earlier, to be more cognizant of that. I think that's an important thing. You know, start out like you're teaching, you know, kindergarten, first grade kids in your mind, and don't assume that they know everything. I had a player come to me my first year in the WNBA, said a really good thing to me, Debbie Black, who played for us, and she said, mm-hmm. Coach, he said, you're giving us too much credit. And I said, what do you mean? You're pretty smart. She goes, yeah, we are in some ways. She said, but you're spoiled by what you just had in your recent NBA thing. He said, we've got to go from A to B to C. We can't go from A to C and skip B. He said, it's just where we are. Other teams can, but we're not. And I think that's the kinds of thing you have to be aware of about your team and the group that you're coaching, is how they learn and how you're going to get it across.
Hmm. Well said. My last question for you is, how do you handle balance in your life?
I've gotten much better about it. I think, you know, having my kids play, I've been very lucky because I coach in the WNBA, and we're in the summer, so I've had a chance to watch my kids play, so I've probably had it handed it to me a little bit easier. But I think the balance part is that, you know, you can be into your job completely, but there are only so many things you can do and have control over. You need as much of a mental break and a physical break as possible. You know, you need to let your mind go away from it. It will refresh you. I do it as simple as there are days, you know, I mean, I got to come home during our season. I got to watch film and I do all that. But I make sure I try to do a workout every day, or I make sure that, you know, that I'm going to sit down and talk with my kids or my wife for a period of time, that we're going to go to a movie, that we're going to do something to get you away from the constant onslaught of it. You know, the business is hard enough as it is, particularly as you go up each level. You feel more outside pressure. We all put pressure on ourselves. I mean, I want to coach. When I was coaching seventh grade, I wanted to win every game. But now I feed my family based on a bunch of 25-year-olds winning and losing. So, but there's only so much I can do. Then they're going to have to play the game. And the sooner you realize that, you know, you can't control everything, every moment that your players have, probably the better you'll become as a coach. The reality is, you know, we'd like them to learn everything we do. I argue with coaches all the time about, you know, things like scouting reports. The average player nowadays at the high school age is going to have about a 10-minute, 15-minute concentration span on scouting reports and stuff. If you think you're going to get them to learn more than that, you're probably kidding yourself and probably trying to satisfy your own conscience or ego. I've learned that you're not going to.
Hmm.